the jihadi who never was. Today, Monday, September 8th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman. Michael Muhammad Knight grew up Catholic in northern New York. Then as a teenager, he found Islam and considered becoming a violent militant.
I was a skinny little teenager who, I wasn't athletic, I'd never touched a gun. You know, I wouldn't have been too useful in that struggle, but that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing.
Also, how friends of executed journalist Stephen Sotloff worked hard to scrub any mention of his Jewish identity from the web.
Stephen was brutally executed, but at the very least, he was not executed because he was a Jew. And I think we can all take, you know, some measure of pride that we're able to stem that flow of information.
Plus, we speak with the British author who says he knows the real identity of Jack the Ripper.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Aaron Schachter, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. What compels someone to drop everything to become a radical Islamist militant? That's a key question this week. On Wednesday, President Obama plans to give a speech about the militant group that calls itself the Islamic State. Obama is expected to make the case for continued U.S. military action against the group. But we want to start today by focusing on just one individual. He isn't and never has been a member of the group also known as ISIS, but his story is relevant. Michael Muhammad Knight calls himself the jihadi who never was. He was raised Catholic in upstate New York, but at 17 he converted to Islam and traveled to Pakistan to receive a religious education. Knight says he seriously considered armed struggle before pulling back. Today, he's a PhD student in Islamic studies at the University of North Carolina, and he wants people to know what drew him to a potentially radical lifestyle. Michael, how do you go from being raised a Catholic, attending Catholic school, to making that big jump across the ocean?
Well, you know, sometimes kids, when they're constructing their identity, they have to kind of push back against the identity that they're fed. And, you know, where I grew up in a little small town in upstate New York, drinking wasn't going to do it. Partying wasn't going to do it. I think Islam was perhaps my teen rebellion.
Right. I had a little bit of rebellion, a little bit of anger when I was got into college. I didn't fly to Pakistan. I mean, you know, there's one thing to go around to different churches or synagogues or study Buddha or whatever, and it's quite another to go to a madrasa in Pakistan.
Yeah. When I was 13, I started getting into, you know, hip-hop, and this was a time in the early 90s when there was a lot of political content and rap music. And at 15, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and it really just transformed me. So, you know, I decided pretty early on in that, you know, around 15, that I was going to be Muslim. At 16, I stepped into a mosque for the first time. My mother drove me there and witnessed my conversion. And then at 17, I was in Pakistan. I believed that I could make a positive contribution.
So I'm going to make sure I understand you. When your mother put you on the plane for Pakistan, you sort of thought in your head that I'm going to be part of a struggle, however that would play out, for peace and righteousness.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't frame it in terms of, you know, military combat, but at some point, you know, this was when the Chechen conflict was really escalating. I just felt that, number one, this life is fleeting. And two, you know, what can I do to make the most of that time to make this world a better place?
I feel to some extent we're dancing around what might have been.
Yeah.
I mean, the Chechen conflict was a very violent conflict. People who felt as you did to some extent went there and took up weapons to fight Russia, right? So that was not in your thoughts?
I mean, I wasn't thinking about that when I got on the plane to Pakistan. But when I was there, you know, there was a lot of buzz around this struggle against Russian occupation in Chechnya. And, you know, at some point it just occurred to me, it's like, you know, what can I really do? I wasn't particularly useful as a fighter. You know, I was a skinny little teenager who, I wasn't athletic. I didn't have a hunting background as many people where I grew up did. I had never touched a gun, and no one had particularly encouraged me to be a violent person. So, you know, I wouldn't have been too useful in that struggle, but that's what I thought I was supposed to be doing.
Hmm. And so what stopped you then?
It was actually the scholars that I was studying with who were deeply conservative, deeply traditionalist, and I don't hold all of their views today, but something that resonated with me was they said that I was here to learn. I was in Pakistan to learn everything from like Arabic classes to history of Islam and practice and just trying to be a better Muslim. And they said, you can do more good for the world with the things that you're learning and your pursuit of knowledge and your intellectual curiosity rather than just going over and being another body in a ditch, was the way they put it.
And in some ways, I imagine they saved your life.
Absolutely, they did, because you know I know that not every kid who believes that he can save the world in that fashion gets the same advice that I did.
So Americans are really questioning why somebody like you might be over there now, might be in Syria or in northern Iraq.
Well, you know, one thing that I try to avoid was I didn't want to enter into the quote-unquote jihadi mind and present this, you know, universal theory of a psychological profile of who these people are. Everyone's experience is going to be different. You know, I had an abusive father that was kind of absent from my life. And, you know, Malcolm kind of became a surrogate father. The Prophet Muhammad became a surrogate father. And so I think part of it, part of moving towards that violence was, for me, repairing a broken sense of manhood.
Michael Muhammad Knight is author of 9 books on his experiences with Islam. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Islamic militant groups don't operate in a vacuum. They have been able to garner support in arms and money and media attention in different parts of the Arab world. An investigation by the New York Times indicates that one culprit is the Gulf state of Qatar, an ostensible U.S. ally. David Kirkpatrick wrote the Times piece. And David, in a nutshell, what is Qatar doing to support Islamic militants, directly or indirectly?
It's very complicated. In Syria, which is where the action is at the moment, Qatar has been a place where private fundraisers can raise money, a lot of money, so that militant groups in Syria, some tied to Al-Qaeda, can buy weapons. It's a place where terrorist fundraising goes on. But it has also been supporting a broad spectrum of Islamists of one sort or another around the region. You know, it's made a bet on the future of political Islam. Its support for more moderate Islamists here in Egypt has really annoyed some of its neighbors. And they're kicking up quite a fuss. They're doing the best they can to point fingers at Qatar as the main culprit in the funding of these Al-Qaeda-linked groups. As some people are even insinuating that Qatar is actually supporting the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is, you know, the worst of the bad actors. There's no evidence that I know of, and no one seriously thinks that Qatar is actually funding ISIS. ISIS has enough money of its own at this point. But that gives you a flavor of just how venomous this dispute within the Gulf states has become.
Do you get the impression that Qatar is actually trying to stir something up? Or are they just sort of moving forward with the theory, as you began by saying, of supporting political Islam? Are they trying to work, Egypt off Saudi Arabia, off the United States, off Syria? Or are they pretty much going forward with a single mission?
Well, you know, they're so promiscuous in their activities around the region that it's hard to say that they're singular in their mission. And clearly, I think anybody would say it's a little bit mischievous, because here is a Gulf emirate that has the largest U.S. military base in the region, a close American ally, and it has a pattern of going as far as it can without stepping over the line with Washington to support Islamists, even militants. You know, it funds but doesn't arm Hamas in Gaza, which the United States considers a terrorist group. You know, they have welcomed leaders of the Taliban. That was with the blessing of the U.S. when the U.S. was trying to work some sort of a deal. But nonetheless, there is a Taliban office in Doha. They are arming Islamist militants in Libya. So this little Gulf state really does have its fingers in a lot of different pots, or its irons in a lot of different fires, depending on what metaphor you want. And it's very hard to generalize.
And what's in it for Qatar? What are they looking for?
You know, they're not very open about explaining that, as you might imagine. You know, some people, including Islamists who've been in Doha recently, have argued to me that what they are really afraid of is actually their big brother, Saudi Arabia, the giant of the Gulf, that as a tiny little Gulf state, they're afraid of becoming a kind of a satellite or vassal of Saudi Arabia. And as a hedge against that, they're trying to cultivate the forces of political Islam around the region. And you know, you could see how a thoughtful person looking at history might say, you know, that's the horse I want to bet on.
That's David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief for The New York Times. It was almost 3 weeks ago on August 19th that the militants who call themselves the Islamic State published the first of two shocking execution videos. That's when friends of kidnapped journalist Stephen Sotloff got to work to keep the extremists from discovering a secret. Reporter Daniel Estrin has the story.
The secret was that 31-year-old Stephen Sotloff was not just an American journalist from Miami. He was Jewish, and he was a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. Islamic State militants held Sotloff for a year, during which his captivity was kept under wraps. Many of his friends didn't even know. So when the Islamic State posted a video of journalist James Foley's beheading and threatened to kill Sotloff next, Sotloff's friend Greg Roman called Sotloff's father.
He said, do what you can do to help our son. I said, I'm going to make sure that no harm comes to Stephen because of his identity.
Roman, who directs the Jewish Community Relations Council in Pittsburgh, put together a group of friends and friends of friends for one mission, to scrub the internet of any mention that Sotloff was Jewish and Israeli so the Islamic State group wouldn't find out. One man recruited for the task was Michael Bassin, an American Jew who travels throughout the Arab Middle East as a trade consultant. He now lives near Tel Aviv.
In the Arab world, they've been taught very, very little about what Jewish people are actually like. And they've been taught they're sinister. They're taught that they have really poor intentions. Being a Jewish person, being a nice guy, they do not go hand in hand. So if they found out that he was Jewish or Israeli, then that means he was a spy and it would have expedited his murder. That was the belief.
Bassin showed me some of the sites he monitored online, mostly Arabic media and the Islamic State's Twitter posts. He didn't find anything that revealed the secret, but when he heard a journalist in Israel was writing a story on Sotloff's Israeli identity, he pushed the journalist to hold the story. Roman says there were volunteers working on shifts to monitor the internet 24 hours a day, and they swiftly contacted American media outlets to remove any reference of Sotloff's Jewish background, including in an article by the New York Times.
The New York Times article with the reference was removed in 27 minutes.
Roman says his group asked friends of Sotloff to untag him in Facebook photos and got Facebook to remove Sotloff's profile. He says they got a rabbi in Los Angeles to remove a sermon online about Sotloff's Jewish background and contacted members of the synagogue so they'd keep quiet too. All in all, he says, there were some 4,000 online mentions of Sotloff's Jewish and Israeli identity they worked hard to remove. One volunteer even went to Sotloff's old college campus in Israel and removed a graduation photo of him from the wall.
Maybe we overreacted in some cases, but whatever it was that we did, it worked.
Did it work? I spoke with a security expert familiar with the Sotloff case. He said the volunteers had good intentions, but their efforts were pointless. The Islamic State held Sotloff for a year, and they could have seen whatever was online about Sotloff during that time, he said. But perhaps the captors didn't know. An Israeli news channel aired a taped conversation with a man it said was a recently released French captive held along with Sotloff. And the man said Sotloff's Jewish identity was kept secret during their captivity. Bassin, one of the volunteers in Israel, says the fact that Sotloff was kept alive for a year gave them the feeling that they could still do something when his captivity was made public.
Stephen was brutally executed, but at the very least, he was not executed because he was a Jew. And I think we can all take, you know, some measure of pride that we're able to stem that flow of information. I think Stephen's memory will be a blessing.
2 weeks after the Islamic State threatened to kill Sotloff, it released a video of his beheading. His executioner made clear his death was in response to U.S. strikes on Islamic State militants. We don't know how knowledge of Sotloff's Jewish and Israeli identity might have affected the course of events, but we do know that he was targeted as an American and killed just the same. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Coming up, is that a fish in your ear? And other trials of translation here on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. So, here's a joke. Two translators are on a ship talking. One asks, "Can you swim?" "No," says the other, "but I can shout for help in 9 languages." Yeah, bad joke. Even though translation won't exactly save you from drowning, it is a key tool to understand the world around us. Over the next few weeks, we'll be exploring how translation impacts our lives in a series we're calling In Other Words. Here's Marco Werman with our first installment.
To kick things off, I wanted to speak with someone who's been a big influence on how I think about translation.
Hello.
Hello, Mom. It's Marco here in Boston.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm fine. This is my mom, Marjolaine Diacher, and I only was able to pronounce her name properly when I was 17, right?
Oh, no. A lot sooner, because little children do much better with funny words than big grown-up children.
All right. We're kicking off this series, Mom, about translation on the show, and I couldn't help but think of you since you've been a translator for many years now. How old were you when you did your first translation or something approximating a professional translation?
About 16, when I had enough hubris, as adolescents tend to have, to think that the rest of the English-speaking world would really be interested in Dutch poetry. So I started with the most difficult genre of all, which is poetry, and did what afterwards I thought was actually a fairly decent job.
So your PhD was in French literature, but then you taught public school for a while, and then you started translating again, Francophone African literature. How did you get into that?
I know, but you tell
our listeners.
When you were in the Peace Corps, I had just finished the PhD, and we came to visit you in Togo, which is a French-speaking West African country. And I was really fed up with doing academic writing, and what I really wanted to do was go back to translation. And you led me to the first West African Francophone novel I ever read, Le Soleil des Indépendances, or The Sun of Independencies. And after that, I just went to the Alliance Française in New York City and started looking at what they had.
Mom, what do you love about translation? Because, I mean, given how little you're sometimes paid, sometimes less than a penny a word, is it a labor of love?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, to me, and one of my favorite books on translation, called Performing Without a Stage, compares translators to the actor who have a script and who then interpret that, performing the script of the writer. And that's, in a sense, what translators do. They rewrite what is being given to them in another language.
Ma mère, my mother, and veteran translator, Marjolaine Diacher. Okay, so if you go by what's in the Bible, we've been in need of translators since the Tower of Babel, which reminds me.
The Babel fish is small, yellow, leech-like, and probably the oddest thing in the universe. If you stick one in your ear, you instantly understand anything said to you in any language.
If only the Babel fish from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy did exist. No worries, though. We've got David Bellows with us. He's the author of Is That a Fish in Your Ear?
The answer is no, it isn't. It's a translator. I mean, there's something going on that is very clever, but it's not magic.
Yeah, well, Google Translate doesn't have the same elegance as the Babel fish. So take us back to the genesis of translation. What were the first translations? How far back does it go? And why initially was there a need to translate?
Oral translation, interpreting, is presumably as old as language itself, because human groups have always spoken different varieties of language and needed some kind of middleman or go-between. But translating written texts, we do actually have an origin, a start point. Writing arose about 5,000 years ago, but it wasn't until just 2,500 years ago that there's anything that looks like a translation. And oddly enough, there are two of them that are almost simultaneous. In the middle of the 3rd century BCE, a community of Greek-speaking Jews in Alexandria in Egypt, which was then a Greek-speaking city, translated the Jewish Torah into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. There are lots of myths and legends surrounding it, but there are no surviving texts of the Old Testament that are older than the Greek translation.
And was that an attempt to convert, or was it just we want you other people to understand what this book is all about?
There are different accounts of understanding it. One story is that Ptolemy II, who was building the great library of Alexandria, wanted a copy of every known book in his library and in Greek, And so therefore his idea was to commission a translation into Greek of the Holy Book of the Jews, maybe. Another story is that the Jews of Alexandria had pretty much lost touch with the language of the Bible. It was a foreign language for them already, and so they actually needed it in Greek to carry on being Jewish. I mean, a bit like American Jews now. I mean, not very many American Jews really can read the Torah in biblical Hebrew. Mm. Within a decade or two of that event on the south shore of the Mediterranean, not terribly far away on the other side of the water in the southern part of Italy, a Greek-speaking slave in a wealthy Roman household was commissioned to translate Homer into Latin. And that, so to speak, the classical tradition begins there. And so in a way you could say that translation of Homer is the beginnings of the invention of a literature in Latin.
So Greek into Latin, Hebrew into Greek. What about English? What impact has translation had on the language we speak?
English was made by translation. Translation from Latin, above all, translation from French.
What words have come into English through translation?
Huge numbers of words came into English in the mashup of the French that the Normans spoke and the Anglo-Saxon that the people spoke. And so English often has two words for the same thing, one of French origin and one of Saxon origin, like, you know, sheep and mutton. Yeah? Sheep was what the peasants looked after and mutton was what the masters ate. And mutton is the French word and sheep is the Germanic or Saxon word. We're constantly translating between these two as we speak English and navigate the different registers of language that are more or less French, depending on how high or low the register is. But I suppose if you want a kind of very straightforward example of a word that's in English only because of a translation and not because of any other need, then there's that famous modern word robot. A robot's actually a Czech word. And it came into English in the translation of Karel Čapek's novel in the 1930s. A robot means a worker in Czech.
You know, I spoke with my mother before we did this interview, and she's a translator and talked about translating her first poems from Dutch to English when she was 16. Mm-hmm. She calls translation a calling. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's a calling in the sense that you can't live off it without some other serious form of employment that pays the rent. When you are a translator, you tend to translate quite a lot of different kinds of things over the years. And part of the real pleasure of being in the field of translation is, you know, how much new stuff you come to learn and get to know in a very intimate way, because translating a book is a way of reading it that is like no other. When you're translating, you're not allowed to skip anything, whereas when you're reading for yourself, you skip bits all the time. But translators aren't allowed to do that. So in a way, the translator of a new book knows that book better than anybody else. And that's a great privilege and a great pleasure.
And that was David Bellows, author of Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Aaron, back to you.
Thanks, Marco. We have more online from David Bellows, including the mystery of why Chaucer wrote the Canterbury Tales in English, not French. That's at PRI.org/language. This is PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. A Nigerian radio soap opera goes to great lengths in the name of realism.
If there's a woman selling tomatoes, we actually have a table where she's selling tomatoes and real tomatoes. Every element that makes the scene as real as possible is included.
The story behind a Nigerian soap called Story Story, just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and you are listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The flood of Central American immigrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border has been a dramatic story now for months. Many of them are kids, and the debate continues. Do we let them in or send them back? Reporter Jude Joffe Block of station KJZZ in Phoenix traveled to El Salvador, and she was there when nine children and their mothers were sent back from a New Mexico family detention facility.
The airport here has a separate terminal for deportation flights. Relatives gather under an awning to wait. A government official explains where the deportees will come out. This summer, hundreds of women and children have been deported from the U.S. back to Central America. Jose Angel waits with his mother-in-law. He's here to pick up his wife, Sonia, who's 23, and their 5-year-old son. They were detained for the last month and a half in New Mexico, in the small town of Artesia.
Fíjese que más que todo era como por un asilo, porque ella la pasaban como amenazando.
Jose Angel says Sonia fled to the U.S. border to seek asylum. Gangs here were threatening her. She had a small chicken farm that made her a target for extortion. Sonia's mother, Judith, says they know several people who've been killed by gangs where they live.
Una es por las extorsiones, porque no dan el dinero, que no lo consiguen. Pues así se vive acá.
She says people are killed because they're extorted. They don't pay the money they owe. It's risky to talk about, which is why the family didn't want their last names used in this report. Still, Sonia's story did not impress the U.S. asylum officer who interviewed her in New Mexico.
El caso de ella era no creíble, le dicen ahí en una entrevista que tienen ahí.
Judith says U.S. officials told her daughter that she failed to prove credible fear, and that's needed to get U.S. asylum.
Mucha gente se fue. Con niños, muchas madres, y sí pasaron.
Judith says she knows lots of other Salvadoran mothers with kids who made it into the U.S. Many Central American migrants detained at the border were placed with relatives to await their day in court. But some families, like Sonia and her son, were sent to the New Mexico detention facility, and many were deported from there quickly. The U.S. government says deporting people faster will prevent more migrants from coming. At the airport, Sonia and her son are about to be released, but the family has to pick them up in a secure area where reporters aren't allowed. So I lose my chance to meet them. But I talked to Sonia later on her cell phone. She explained she left the U.S. voluntarily after learning she wouldn't likely win asylum. She says another reason she left is because her son couldn't eat anything at the detention facility. She claims they were served raw meat that was bloody. Her son had a fever for 8 days, and she couldn't get him medicine at first. Other detainees have made similar claims. Sonia also says she didn't get to talk to a lawyer until after she'd been interviewed by an asylum officer. A new federal lawsuit claims that allegations like that, and there are others, show a lack of due process at the New Mexico facility.
The fundamental issue at the facility is that it is not giving those women and their kids a fair day in court.
Karen Tumlin is an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center, one of the groups suing over conditions in the New Mexico facility. It's not clear if Sonia had a winning asylum case, but Tumlin says many women detained in that New Mexico facility do. Yet they're being sped through without time to prepare cases.
And really what amounts to a rush to judgment to deport as many of these women and kids as quickly as possible.
In an email, immigration officials stated that the treatment of migrants has been, quote, humane and lawful. They also said the food served to detainees in the New Mexico facility is the same food served to staff. In El Salvador, Sonia and her family are now living again in the same house where she was threatened. I ask if I can visit her there, but she says that's a bad idea.
Aquí no pueden entrar carros desconocidos.
She says the gangs don't let unknown cars drive in.
No he salido de la casa nomás ahora que fui a la tienda porque da miedo.
She says she's scared to leave the house, and if she's threatened again, she'll likely move, maybe to another Latin American country, since now it's clear there's no future for her family in the United States. For The World, I'm Jude Joffe Block, San Salvador.
Reporter Kate Sheehy contributed to that story. It comes to us from the Fronteras Desk, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest. As Jude reported, thousands of migrant families have been detained all along the U.S.-Mexico border. We've mapped out just where the families are being held. You can see that graphic at PRI.org. Decades ago, Save the Whales was more than just a mocking cliche about environmentalists. It was a rallying cry to literally save some of our planet's most majestic creatures. And it helped change the way many of us thought about nature. The movement to save the whales has also largely been successful, by the way. Here's the latest indication. A new study has just found that the population of blue whales, the biggest of all whales in the eastern Pacific, seems to be back to near historic levels. Trevor Branch at the University of Washington in Seattle is co-author of the report. And Dr. Branch, how many blue whales are there now off your coast these days?
We think there are about 2,200 blue whales off the west coast of the U.S.
Comparing it to when?
Well, they started off before whaling about 2,200 blue whales in this northeast Pacific population. Whaling started in 1905, but before that, the boats weren't fast enough, the harpoons weren't good enough to chase after blue whales and catch them. So we know pretty much when whaling started. Whaling hit a peak in the late 1920s when more than half the population was caught in 5 years. And then in the 1960s, there was another period when the Soviet Union had a massive fleet of whaling vessels and they were catching whales and not reporting what they were catching. So after the Soviet whaling, they went back down to about 60% of what was there. And since 1971, there have been no catches at all, and 4 decades of recovery have worked well.
Well, as we started off by saying, it seems like the bumper stickers worked. How do we know this, though?
People go out in boats, and you take lots and lots of pictures of blue whales, and they have unique markings on their sides. So you can tell when you've re-sighted the same blue whale. You can use a bit of math in those photographs to come up with current numbers.
Now, I'm in our studios here, and we have a big map of the world on the wall, and the Pacific Ocean looks like a pretty big place. How exactly do you go out and count whales?
Well, we're pretty lucky off this coast that most of our blue whales come within a few dozen miles of the coast, and so you can photograph most of them.
Okay, so we're talking about a specific group of whales.
Yeah, we're talking about what we call either California, Mexico population or the Northeast Pacific population. Globally, most of the blue whales that ever existed used to be in the Antarctic. And that population has gone down to very low levels. We estimate that something like 99.85% of all of those blue whales were caught. And even now, even after a few decades of recovery, they're probably only at 1% of what they used to be. Okay. So if you want the sort of whole world picture, we're probably at about 5 or 10%. It's really only this California population that's doing well.
So this is kind of a good news, bad news story. And when we did talk about the Save the Whales campaign, it's not just blue whales. But I wonder what's so important about this particular group of whales?
They're the biggest animal that's ever existed on the Earth. They're 3 times bigger than the biggest dinosaur that ever existed. So they're just iconic. They were really the face of the Save the Whales campaign.
What do people do with whales?
Back in the day, a lot of them were used for margarine and soap.
Oh, jeez.
when they were caught in the 60s, it was mostly for meat to feed the Soviet Union.
Wow. What are the biggest threats now to these humongous creatures?
The biggest threat right now is ship strikes. You know, even though blue whales are big, these cargo ships are something like 1,000 times bigger than a blue whale. And any collision between a blue whale and a cargo ship is not going to end well. So it's thought that somewhere around 10 or 11 per year are hit by cargo ships off the West Coast and killed. And even though our study suggests this isn't stopping them recovering, it's still well above the U.S. legal limit. And people are trying to move the shipping lanes. They're trying to slow down the ships to reduce those deaths as much as they can.
Trevor Branch is at the University of Washington in Seattle. Trevor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Many have tried to crack the mystery of Jack the Ripper, but for over a century, no one has been able to conclusively identify the serial killer who terrified London's Whitechapel district back in 1888. There have been suspects and countless theories, but no positive ID on the killer. Until now, according to Russell Edwards. He's the author of a new book in which he claims to reveal Jack the Ripper's true identity. And Mr. Edwards, where is the proof?
Well, the evidence comes from a silk shawl that was taken at the murder scene of the 4th murder victim of Jack the Ripper. And the murder victim's name was Catherine Eddowes. Now, we managed to extract the DNA from both the blood, which is on the shawl, or what we would like to say, the bodily fluids from the victim.
Okay. You and Dr. Lohelainen, who is a molecular biologist, tested the shawl. What did you find out?
The first set of testing is we got a match with the blood from the shawl and the great-great-granddaughter of Catherine Eddowes. So we now were able to place the shawl at the scene of the murder. Of course, this was extremely exciting, but it also took the research and the significance of what we were doing to another level. We then managed to identify the origins of the shawl, and it came from Russia. So here we have a shawl that was taken to the murder scene by the murderer, and Yari identified on the shawl semen stains. So then all of a sudden, wouldn't it be amazing if these semen stains on there were from Jack the Ripper? And from there, I managed to trace a descendant of the Ripper, and we got a conclusive match in February.
I have to say, this has given me goosebumps. Here's the moment. We've kept people in suspense long enough. So you've matched DNA to the man that you believe is Jack the Ripper. And
that's right.
That man is?
That man is Aaron Kosminski, one of the three main suspects identified by the chief of the investigation at the time of the murders. Now, Aaron Kosminski at the time of the murders was a 23-year-old Polish immigrant that came into Whitechapel in 1881 with his family. And then shortly after the murders, he was sent to Colney Hatch Lunatic Asylum after being diagnosed with mania.
There is skepticism here. Miss Eddowes was the victim here, was apparently a prostitute. So the question is, you know, how do you know that this man was a killer and not a client?
Because of the research that we found, that the shawl wasn't owned by Catherine Eddowes. In fact, she'd had no contact with it until she was murdered. We know that it was his shawl and not hers. So we had the what we call evidence of split body parts. So the Ripper took Catherine Eddowes' kidney and he took her uterus, and it's evidence that he placed one of those bodily parts on the shawl. The blood has matched the descendant's DNA, so we know it was there at the scene of the crime.
Where are you getting DNA from Mr. Kosminski 120 years later?
Okay, I had to find a descendant from his relative down the female line again, because we used mitochondrial DNA to get the match. And on the first test, there was a 99.2% match. And on the second test, there was a 100% match.
So you went to a descendant of Aaron Kosminski.
Yes.
And said, we believe your great something was Jack the Ripper. Can we have a sample of your DNA?
It wasn't as easy as that by any means. She obviously knew that her great uncle was a Ripper suspect at the time. This lady was very intrigued to find out more, and my honesty came across that I'm actually trying to solve the case and not try and harm the family in any way, which is why I'm not identifying her. And she was more than cooperative.
Huh. So, Mr. Edwards, now that it's over, a bit of a letdown?
No. The most amazing thing ever that happened to me in my entire life, and I don't think I'll ever do anything as historical as this ever again.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you search for next?
Well, you know, I'd like to know a bit more about him. Why did he brutalise these women in such a way, in such a ritualistic way? How did he just vanish into thin air? There's still unanswered questions. What was the start to this? What was the trigger for him to decide, I'm going to go and do what he did?
And you expect to find an answer to that?
You know, I think after 14 years, I think I'd like a break.
That's Russell Edwards telling us about his theory based on DNA evidence that points to the real Jack the Ripper. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Before we head to the break, I want to give you a heads up about a couple of great stories we're working on for tomorrow. The first features a Toyota dealer in Libya. He's trying to steer clear of the fighting there, but here's the problem he's facing. Local warlords love his pickup trucks.
We are bound by contract to refuse to sell to anybody who might use our products to cause chaos.
He hasn't had much luck with that. And while you're tuning in tomorrow, stick around for a story we'll have from Colorado. African immigrants have been coming to the Centennial State for decades, but now some of them are preparing to make their mark in politics.
When we came, most of us say, I'm going to go back in 5 years,
5 years and we're still here. 10 years, we're still here. So you get to a point where you begin to tell yourself, I'm here now. You know, it's worth for me to get involved.
African immigration and its potential impact on local Colorado politics, that's tomorrow right here on The World. And you're listening to The World on PRI. African immigration and its potential impact on local Colorado politics. That's tomorrow right here on The World. And you're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, and you're dialed in to The World. It's been a long time since we Americans turned to our radios for a soap opera fix. But in Nigeria, the radio soap opera is alive and kicking. And one of the most popular Nigerian radio dramas aims to do a lot more than just entertain. Our man keeping an ear out for all things unusual in global radio is The World's Leo Hornack in London. And Leo, what makes this show called Story Story such a hit?
Well, Aaron, I think probably the best way to explain some of why people are so gripped by this show is just to play you a little bit of it. This is from a classic episode, and I want you to just picture the scene. This is a political rally in Nigeria, and one of the show's much-loved characters, Tammy, has been handed a mysterious package.
Well, that's a little shocking.
Well, as you can guess, Aaron, the package actually contained a bomb. And that was how Story Story's listeners discovered. And you can probably hear, maybe just under my voice, some of the kind of choral music to indicate that her going up to heaven. And that was how listeners discovered that Tammy had been killed. And I think that tells you a little bit about this show. You know, Story Story is not really a soap in the kind of Dallas or dynasty tradition. It's not about the lives of the rich and famous. It's really about ordinary Nigerians living quite difficult lives in a sometimes very dangerous world. And that has enormous appeal in Nigeria.
A quick translation there. Dynasty is dynasty in American.
Oh, my apologies. I will also say a story story in that case with a Nigerian accent. How much further would you like me to go in transatlantic translation, Aaron?
We'll leave it there, Leo. Tell me why the drama on radio is so popular in Nigeria. Why not television?
Well, I think part of the answer to that lies in how people use radio in West Africa. I mean, the show focuses on daily life in and around a typical market. And that's the kind of environment where people still turn to the radio for news, entertainment, and education as they work. I mean, not everyone necessarily has access to a TV. But there's a bit more to it than that. I think we sometimes think of radio drama as being a little bit old-fashioned, a bit creaky, a bit prairie home companion. But the people who make this program have found ways of learning from rival media and beating them at their own game. So I spoke to the show's producer, Zoza Itcha, and here's what she told me about that.
We don't produce Story Story in a studio. Story Story is shot on location, recorded on location, like it's done for TV. If there's a woman selling tomatoes, we actually have a table where she's selling tomatoes and real tomatoes. If she's selling vegetables, there are real vegetables. Every element that makes the scene as real as possible is included.
Wow, that is really amazing. It's kind of, you know, what's old is new again. It's real radio there.
Well, I mean, what you didn't hear is what one thing she told me as well is that it's called a radio movie and people call it a radio movie. And that gives you a sense of the kind of cinematic objective that Story Story has.
So, Leo, we've been hearing a lot about Ebola these days in Africa and how it's being covered by the media in Africa. Is that the kind of issue that a radio movie can take on?
Well, I mean, it is. And I'd have to warn listeners of Story Story might hear this. There's going to be a bit of a spoiler coming up because this has been a major issue for the show and it's coming up in the next series. And I can give you a bit of an exclusive here, Aaron, that one of the major characters, Montu the truck driver, I'm told by the producers, has just come back from Liberia, and he is going to encounter a whole series of rumors because of where he's been, because he's been in an Ebola hotspot. People start to avoid him. His business starts to suffer. People are suspicious of him. And this is all because people don't fully understand how Ebola is really transmitted. And I think that storyline goes to the heart of the show's other aim, which is to educate as well as to entertain. And the idea is that using radio and strong stories, strong characters, and the kind of vivid production you heard can reach people in a way that maybe an official health warning about Ebola probably couldn't. And it seems to have a real grip on people. Here's what Zoza, the producer, told me about the feedback they got after that bomb blast that killed the character Tammy.
People are writing us on Facebook and begging that, okay, can Tammy come back as a ghost? We were a little overwhelmed as to how to calm the audience for taking Tammy away suddenly like that. They see these characters as themselves.
Leo, we've talked about how Story takes to the street to create some of its episodes. Do you get an impression about how realistic it is?
Well, what really struck me is just how vivid and that radio movie idea, how true that is. When you listen to Story, you're not hearing just a few actors reciting lines. You're pulled into the action. And just one more thing that really struck me about this is it works. Zoza, the producer, she told me that she recently went into a department store and everyone was walking slowly. Why? Because Story was on. They didn't want to make a noise with their feet and miss a moment of dialogue. And she felt that that really proved that this was actually working as a way of getting stories across to people.
The World's Leo Hornack. Thanks a lot, Leo. That was great.
No problem, Aaron. Thank you very much.
Nigeria also features in our final musical note today. The Lagos Music Salon is the name of a new CD by a singer who goes by the name Somi. She was born in Illinois to parents from Rwanda and Uganda, but it's the music scene in Lagos, Nigeria that informs Somi's new album. Somi immersed herself in the Lagos music scene for 18 months. She tested her jazz and soul-tinged compositions by playing them for audiences at small venues around Nigeria's largest city. And she often invited local musicians to perform with her. It all seems to have paid off, as you can hear on the album. Oh, African man, don't you know? With a fist your love don't show. Take my hand, let's leave this valley. Strength and love to guide me. I'm your lady, I'll be your queen. Try to harm me, you'll hear me scream. I gon' say I believe you. I gon' say I believe you. Lady Revisited by Somi closes our show today. It's off her new album, The Lagos Music Salon, and features a guest musician popular here at The World, Angelique Kidjo. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter, and we are back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, annenbergfoundation.org, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.